The following episode was recorded before the complaint was taken out against Vince McMahon by Janelle Grant.
They were so cowardly, they wouldn't even meet with us and wouldn't talk to us. And so here you have this person that you're targeting, the charge, coming and saying, here, do you have anyone want to ask me anything? Ask me whatever you want to ask me. And they were gutless. They wouldn't do it.
Welcome back to Dark Side of the Ring Unheard, the podcast from the hit Vice TV series where we dive in to the Dark Side archive in search of insights, tall tales, poignancy, and recollection from some of pro wrestling's most famous and infamous. I'm Jack Encarnacio from the Lapsed Fan Wrestling Podcast, joined by my Lapsed Fan co-host JP Sorrow, as well as, of course, Dark Side of the Ring's executive producer and co-creator, Evan Husney. You know, we've spent time in the past with New Jack and getting acquainted with courts and legal ramifications and skirting the very edges of the law. This time on Unheard, we get acquainted with the other side of the legal aisle. And as far as pro wrestling and Vince McMahon in particular are concerned, this guy is the heavyweight champion. Jerry McDevitt represented the WWE for some 35 years, including in Vince McMahon's blockbuster 1994 federal trial in New York on steroid distribution allegations, which of course threatened to bring the powerhouse World Wrestling Federation, today WWE, to its knees and land McMahon in prison. Jerry sat for Dark Side Cameras 2 years ago for a look at the steroid trials, and Evan, this particular barrister, let's say he did not hold back in recounting what it was like to defend a one-of-one personality like Vince McMahon.
That's right. I mean, Jerry McDevitt was a big get for Dark Side, and it was definitely key in making this episode possible. Because I remember back when we were doing season one of the show and sketching out what are the biggest stories in wrestling, what are the biggest, you know, controversial, you know, crazy stories that happened in this world that have not really been, you know, covered in long form on television, like what would be the tentpole stories. And this was always at the top of the list for us to dig into. But it was we had a really hard time in the beginning trying to find voices and subjects who would agree to go on camera. I mean, we had no street cred back in those days during season one. Nobody knew who we were. And so we got a lot of no's. Like everyone said no. We had no. There was nothing we could do to get people on board for the show. The only person we had on board for the show back then was Nails. Shout out Nails.
Who didn't end up making it in anyway. He didn't sit for the cameras.
That's right. He wound up declining, you know, the one time when we did, you know, get it going. but you know, season two, we tried again, no luck. And so when we were tasked with season three, which, you know, is the largest, it's 14 episodes long. It's a huge season. We really wanted to try and figure it out some way, somehow. And I remember we were sitting around and trying to, you know, in one of the meetings, trying to figure out how we would do it, what would be the angle. And then it was somebody sort of suggesting, well, what if we were able to get Jerry McDevitt? Because that was always a thought that maybe we wouldn't for some reason, that, you know, because he's a WWE, he's on that side of the fence. You know, and from what we've been told and what we know, people on the WWE side won't sit for Dark Side cameras. So this just seemed an impossible feat. But it of course, wasn't the case. And we started thinking about, you know, Dark Side of the Ring is very influenced by Errol Morris's The Thin Blue Line, that documentary, seminal true crime film from the 80s. We borrowed a lot stylistically from that. But the other Errol Morris film that comes to mind when I think about Jerry McDevitt and telling this story is The Fog of War. The idea, you know, when Errol Morris in the early 2000s made a doc film about Robert McNamara, you know, who is our Secretary of Defense. And it was just a solo piece. It was just a one-on-one interview, Errol Morris interviewing McNamara. And I sort of felt like, well, what if we really leaned into, like, you know, this is just the Jerry McDevitt show, you know, and really... And it was also very unique for us to tell a story, I thought, and very fresh at the time, to just tell a story totally, purely from the WWE perspective, you know, which it pretty much is. I mean, it's not purely because you have other people who are obviously reporting on it and who are there, but the main thrust of the story is from, you know, the Jerry McDivitt and his clients, you know, fighting the battle of their lives in the courtroom. And that's a very unique perspective than what you might think you might get on Dark Side of the Ring. So I thought it'd be very exciting and fresh for us to do. And lo and behold, man, we were able to get Jerry McDivitt.
This guy is so game to go. And JP, we've spent a lot of time on The Lapsed Fan reading through every word of the 1994 trial transcripts when Vince McMahon was, his fate was on the line, his liberty was on the line. And we got a real sense for how Jerry McDivitt worked his magic. In that case, as explained in the documentary on Dark Side, Jerry was actually representing WWE as an organization, whereas another attorney by the name of Laura Bervetti, who was a heavy hitter from New York, represented Vince personally. But nonetheless, McDivitt is really running point on a lot of critical elements of the preparation for this trial and, of course, the in-court arguments. And when you hear the words and you see him in action, both in front of the judge and at sidebar, you know, without calling a single witness, Vince McMahon walks. What was it like to see the man on Dark Side of the Ring, hear his war stories in his own voice?
The first thing I want to point out, you go into his office and he's got all these pictures on the wall. And the one that he focuses on, it's a frame, contains a bunch of articles, and it's not about Vince's acquittal. It's of the indictment.
Yeah.
That's Jerry McDivitt. It's not about the victory. It's about the challenge.
Right.
And I was just like, Mike, I rewatched it and I didn't notice that the first time I saw it. And I was like, holy shit. He's hungry. And he even says later on, he was excited.
Oh yeah.
That Vince got indicted. So we could, what do you say? Kick the government's ass.
Well, finally. Yeah. Finally, we can actually hash this out instead of dealing with subpoenas and process arriving at the office from the summer of 1992, calling everyone Vince ever knew, it seemed like, in to testify. Let's just get this rolling. And it wasn't until November of 1993 that the indictment was announced. And it must have been refreshing for you guys, Evan, to realize that this is a bit of a shrine to this trial in McDivitt's office there in Pittsburgh. He's got the courtroom sketches and everything.
Oh, yeah. I'll never forget, you know, when he first told me that he had the court sketch of the verdict, where it's, you know, you see Jerry hugging Vince, hugging Linda, just as the verdict's being read. And of course, at the end of the episode, when he's showing it to the cameras, he's pointing out that the jury's or the people in the audience are clapping, you know, that, and it's just amazing. And that image is incredible. It should be a t-shirt, that sketch. And that to me was like, wow, this is going to be really special, because I do remember first reaching out to him. And it was, like I was saying, we pretty much assumed it'd be a no, or he'd never get back to us, or potentially this was sort of opening up some sort of line of communication with the WWE that we didn't want, you know, like it was, you know, this was a risky sort of move. But I called his offices, spoke to his assistant and said, you know, who I am, and I would love to speak to Jerry about something. And he called me right back, and we spent a few hours on the phone, literally a few hours on the phone, talking about the show. He had seen all the episodes, which freaked me out, you know, so he was well
aware. Yeah, that's actually, that's maybe not the best thing at first brush.
Right. No, I know. And of course, you know, we spent a good part of the phone conversation, you know, talking about the Owen Hart episode. Of course, he had a lot to say about that.
Right, right.
And I took all of his notes, you know, that he had to heart. And I was like, okay, fair enough. And then I just said, hey, let me throw an idea out at you. You know, look, we're in our season three. We've always wanted to cover the steroid trials. You know, this is your biggest trial moment. I mean, I think it is. This is your biggest legal victory. This is a huge part of your story. And I think, you know, wrestling fans have heard your name. They sort of know it, you know, from different articles and things, but no one really knows your story. And I think it'd be really interesting to tell the story of the steroid trials through your perspective. And then he got to really thinking about it. And I assume that he had to go back to, you know, the chairman and ask if it was, you know, okay for him to do. That's what my assumption is.
It's a fascinating question. I wonder if that's necessarily true.
I have a feeling that it would be.
Yeah.
Because I think just because of the nature that it is, you know, a story largely about Vince and, you know, wanting to make sure it was okay, right, with the client. I don't, who knows? But I would imagine that he did, and then he got back to me and was like, okay, let's start really talking about this. And then when we went down to, I think it was Naples, Florida, where he's got a house down there, and we went down and we shot the interview in like, because he kind of lives in like one of those, you know, what is it, like a kind of like gated community down there, and they have their own little recreational center, you know, there. And so he put me in touch with the manager of that, and we got the interview, you know, we were able to shoot there. Everybody was very nice. And yeah, he was well prepared, which you can definitely imagine, you know, having those kind of umbrella, I don't know what you call those kind of legal, you know, huge, like accordion size folders of just massive amounts of documents and reference. And, but he was ready to go, and he was very excited, and he was super, super nice. And, you know, we had a lot of conversations beforehand and wanted to get a thing straight. He wanted to make sure this wasn't going to be a hit piece. I know that he didn't want this to be something that was just looking to show, you know, Vince in a bad light or anything. And it was like, no, I mean, this is your perspective. You're the main character. We want to build this thing around you. So, you know, you tell us the story from your perspective and, you know, let's go. And so he was very keen to do that. And we interviewed him on two separate occasions because there was a ton of information we had to get from him. And yeah, it was great. It was a great experience.
How long is the Raw interview?
I think there's probably like 2 4-hour interviews, I want to say.
Wow. Holy shit.
Yeah, he sat on two different occasions.
Yeah, he did. And I was very nervous about what he would think of the episode, obviously thinking in the back of my head, like, this guy probably has not only the capabilities, but the hunger, as you said,
oh, yeah,
to take some legal action. No, but he was, so I was nervous, just like, you know, hopefully that, you know, he felt like we did the episode, you know, justice, that we did it, you know, just like we had discussed. And and he was very happy with it, which was super cool. He sent me a text message after it aired, saying, you know, I can't, paraphrasing, but something like, you know, you did exactly what you told me you would, and you were honest, and da 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 da. So it was cool, you know. But yeah, it's kind of cool.
That's the great response right there. You did exactly what you told me you do.
Yeah,
because I made sure to record exactly what you said you would do.
That's right.
Right, because the recorder in my pocket, as we were talking, said otherwise.
I mean, yeah, and it's fascinating because, you know, this might stand as the closest thing he might have to, you know, a testimonial to his legal career and what undoubtedly he'd consider one of his biggest legal victories.
Yeah.
Shortly after this aired, it was announced just this past summer that Jerry McDivitt actually is essentially retiring from the practice of law, or at least retiring from representing WWE, as they're involved in a lawsuit right now against another wrestling company. And suddenly in the middle of the lawsuit, the word comes from McDivitt that, you know, he felt like, with the age he was at and the amount of discovery that was coming up, he's at 74 years old, and he may even be a witness in the case, you know, based on where it's heading, he withdrew his counsel, and it basically marked the end of the Jerry McDivitt representing WWE relationship, which went back some 35 years. So it was a very timely approach as well from you guys. I would imagine if he was thinking in the back of his mind that he might not have too many more you know, balls to the wall battles for the biggest wrestling company in the world under, you know, in him, capable of doing.
Never say never, brother. You know, well, got one more run.
Well, because of Jerry McDivitt, in large part, it seems like, the Anvil Neidhart, who we all know is a standout member of the Hart Foundation tag team and a member of the famous Hart wrestling family from throughout the 80s and the 1990s, of course, teamed with Bret the Hitman Hart as the Hart Foundation in the WWF and were tag team champions, father of the current WWE superstar Natalia Neidhart. He may have not had one more run in him, at least in the bright spotlights of the WWF, had it not been for McDivitt, because what didn't make it into the final cut is sort of the origin story of how Jerry McDivitt, this Pittsburgh attorney, came to represent the WWE. The firm he was working for, or an associate of his, was working for WWF at the time when they were just sort of beginning to become an absolute pop culture sensation and a national television attraction. And there were some issues on the road with drug use and recreation and guys getting into all kinds of mischief, living the life of, you know, rock stars on the road, essentially, just with also the physical toll of having to punish your body every night on top of it. And so what happens is Jim the Anvil Neidhart ends up in a situation where he's on a flight, and some of the crew members on the flight accuse him of getting a little too rambunctious, perhaps a little too physical regarding whether or not he was being appropriately served on the plane. These were the allegations, of course. And so that's, you know, if you do that in the air, that's a federal offense. So that's a big deal. And they sought out counsel, and the lawyer that was working for WWF at the time couldn't take the case. So he asked Jerry McDevitt, can you represent this guy? He's a wrestler and all this, but Jerry McDevitt does not know in 1987 what world he's about to step into defending Jim the Anvil Neidhart from these allegations. So on this piece of sound from the archives, Jerry discusses the moment that Jim the Anvil Neidhart, a client the likes of which he has never seen, his law partners have never seen, he's trying to climb in the legal profession, and out of the elevator steps this larger-than-life pro wrestler.
To come meet us, and he lets me know he's coming up in the elevator. So I go to the elevator bank, and I'm waiting for this guy to get off. I don't even know what he looks like. And meanwhile, Mr. Lockhart, who was the senior partner and named partner of the place, a very refined gentleman, I swear, he used to wear a suit coat when he went to the bathroom. That's the way he was. Very elegantly dressed all the time. So he's standing there, and I'm waiting for the elevator to open. And again, I was just an associate. So it's me as an associate, senior partner, standing there, and the elevator door opens, and off gets this guy with wraparound shades, the ZZ Top beard, about 6'1", looked about 280 pounds of solid granite. And the first thing he does when he gets off the elevator is he pushes the ashtray and spits this big wad of tobacco.
Oh, my God.
Right, and Mr. Lockhart's standing there looking at him. And I'm thinking, my career's over. I mean, that's, he just ended my career with what he did there. And so we go up to the office and start talking to him, and he said he had to call this guy named Vince. And I said, what do you got? Well, he's the owner. I got to call him. And he was petrified of calling him. And I'm thinking the whole time, I don't know who this Vince guy is, but if he's afraid of him, I want to meet this Vince guy, because Neidhart was one of the most scary-looking human beings. He was actually a nice guy, but he was just scary-looking. And so, you know, we placed a call to Vince from our office, and that was the first time I heard Vince's voice sort of on the phone talking to Neidhart. And I remember thinking at the time, this guy must be like a lion tamer. I mean, he was very strong voice, was kind of chewing him out for getting in trouble and doing dumb stuff if he had done it and whatnot. And I just remember thinking at the time, this guy must have a very strong personality to be dealing with these kind of people this way.
Turned out to be an understatement, JP. I mean, he's under the tent now. There's no going back. He's now associated with pro wrestling and pro wrestlers. And if he does a good job representing Jim Neidhart, you can bet there's more phone calls to come.
You know what he reminds me of? Like, McDevitt, he reminds me of, we've all seen Citizen Kane. You know, there's that scene where he doesn't remind me of any specific person, but what he reminds me of is there's that scene after Kane loses the election and Orson Welles and Joseph Cotton are in the empty room, and they're just like, you know, the camera, it's that famous story, you know, where he rips out the floorboards and whatever to get the camera really, really low. And it's like, that to me is Jerry McDivitt. He's just this towering essence that can destroy you.
If that's what it calls for. I mean, he does say, I'm going to squash you like a bug during the course of the documentary. And he successfully, not only did he successfully defend Jim Neidhart from these charges, but then he turned around and filed a damages complaint against the accusers and got like a six-figure settlement out of them. So, Evan, that's how you win Vince McMahon's loyalty.
I actually remember when we were first talking about this episode, sketching out, you know, how we were going to structure it and what parts of the story we would touch on. And I remember being pretty bummed out that we didn't have room for this in the episode, because it is quite cinematic. It almost feels like something you'd see out of like a late 80s comedy, you know, or something. This idea of like, you know, the very straight lawyer and all of his colleagues, and oh, here comes the zany rock and roll guy, you know, out of the elevator.
The pro wrestler who comes to Frasier for a, you know, some therapy.
Yeah, and he's wearing the Zubaz and the whole thing. And so to me, that felt very cinematic, but what a fortuitous thing, you know, of like these two worlds colliding. And I do love the friction of something, you know, these two opposite ends of the universe, you know, colliding, you know, into this, like the weird, wild world, colorful world of wrestling. And this encounter would have completely changed Jerry's life, the company's life, everyone's life, you know, in wrestling, this sort of innocuous thing. And just to know that, you know, to the ends in which Jerry went to get Jim Neidhart, you know, cleared of this, you know, this case, you know, is interviewing like a majority of the people who were on flight, you know, going to the ends of the earth in order to, you know, and, you know, to go deep with research and to talk to people. And of course that would pay off in dividends with the steroid trials. I mean, he literally became the foremost researched expert of steroids, probably in the United States by the time.
To hear him tell it. And really you could tell from the trial that they did not expect that level of artillery from this guy. Like, not to say that he's not capable, but it's so much more research into the history of steroids in this country than you would expect an attorney to do to defend the charges that Vince McMahon was facing. And it was quite something.
And it is kind of, not to get too off subject, but as you see in the episode, you know, one of the big turning points in the trial is him, you know, bringing up that research, bringing up the research of Anavar, and sort of, you know, making this very babyface argument, you know, this kind of underdog, you know, sort of argument that you'd also see like in a courtroom drama, of sort of saying that, like, you know, well, if we're being accused of, and I'm paraphrasing, obviously, if we're being accused of defrauding the FDA, you know, well, what's the, how the FDA is protecting, like, how are they protecting us from this drug that can kill people, you know? And that's like it's such a cinematic moment, you know, combining that and also the, you know, the circus that is pro wrestling. And it's just amazing.
If he was afraid that his career was over when Jim Neidhart stepped off the elevator in his law office back in 1987, he was wrong. His career was just getting started, and there would be many more cases to come, many more opportunities for Jerry McDivitt to defend the WWF and its wrestlers. And so as time goes, as we mentioned, come the summer of 1992, the WWF starts receiving subpoenas for people related to the company and wrestlers and such to offer testimony and deposition, essentially, on what they know about the use of steroids in wrestling and in the WWF in particular. It's a big, complicated legal thing, which the episode does a pretty swift job of explaining. But essentially, the possession of anabolic steroids federally was not illegal in this country until federal law changed. There was one law that changed in 88, and then one that changed in 91 that made it, you know, just as illegal by that time to possess steroids in your hand as cocaine, essentially. But you know, that timetable is very important because, you know, as much as prosecutors can dig up about steroid use in wrestling, it's not about whether it happened, although certainly the American public was very interested in that detail, is about when it happened and what was the state of the law at the time. And so, as it's becoming clear that the feds are building a case against Vince McMahon, there had been a doctor that had given wrestler steroids at shows in Pennsylvania for years named George Zahorian, who had just been sentenced to jail for doing this. It was sort of like an outgrowth, one could think, from that base of research and prosecution that went into that doctor. It's very clear that it's time to prepare for Vince McMahon to come up on charges, alleging that he had, you know, some role in maybe tacitly or perhaps expressly condoning the use of steroids, perhaps even after that wasn't necessarily kosher with U.S. law. And so Jerry McDivitt starts going through the process of preparing, and one of the things he realizes he's got to do, because this is just the kind of thing you do when preparing for a trial, is you want to get an idea of how the public at large feels about the nature of the allegations against your client. He needs to know how the public feels about steroids. And so it's time for a focus group. There's always someone ready to, you know, invoice you for a focus group in this world. And preparing for a federal trial is no different. So McDivitt goes in there trying to learn, how does the public feel according to this focus group about steroids, and how should that inform the way I go about defending my client. If you think he takes every suggestion or even one of them, you don't know Jerry McDivitt.
And I remember the moderator of the focus group saying, well, the lesson of this is, you know, into trial, you can't say or do anything that would remotely look like you're trying to defend the use of steroids. And I remember thinking, well, that's stupid, because the trial is going to be about people who use steroids. So you have to explain, why did they do that in a common sense way, you know?
Stroke of genius, JP. Let's just not pretend like this is a trial about us trying to deny that wrestlers do steroids. Let's instead focus it entirely on why they do them and try to win the juror's sympathy for that reason.
I want to know, do you guys know what his record is? Like, what's his trial record? Because I swear to God, like, this guy, he has such ingenuity when it comes to thinking out of the box, or, like, you know, knowing where the line is and stepping on it and doing a tightrope walk if necessary. You know, he just is so, everything is possible for him. There is no way I'm losing a case, and I'm going to find a way to make sure I don't lose a case.
He did say on the episode, Evan, I really didn't think about losing. Like, you know, he was asked a couple of times by you, like, what did you think about what could happen here? You know, expecting him to say, you know, well, I don't want Vince to go to jail. But he was like, no, not going there.
I know, because he wasn't taking any of the bait on that, which is, you know, trying, you know, for the course of the, for, you know, dramatic purposes in the episode, like, to at least, you know, is there any tension of doubt? Is there any, like, you know, sleepless nights that we can build up the drama of getting into this? None of that. Nope. I wasn't fazed one bit. And the thing,
but in a weird way, that kind of, like, that actually makes it even more intriguing, because it makes him, like, you know, it makes him almost like a Superman in that regard.
Well, how about this? I mean, you were talking about his record, you know, you were talking about some stats, you know, on him. Yeah. And I think one important stat is the fact that, of course, you know, there were other folks on the legal team, of course, but the fact that they didn't call a single witness, you know, is crazy and bold and pretty wild. And, you know, obviously he sums it up in the episode by saying, well, if I lost, then it would look extra bad, you know, if we didn't call any witnesses, because, oh, wow, this guy didn't call anybody up here to defend the poor guy. But I think it just is a testament that, and what that means for people who don't know, is that means that basically he's winning his case on the strength of him and his, you know, and Laura Brevetti, who is the other, you know, legal person assigned to the case, who is defending Vince McMahon. The case was won by them solely on their cross examinations of the prosecution's witnesses,
having read through the entire transcript with Jack, like, he rips them to shreds.
Yeah,
every chance.
He definitely, like, leaves the jury, you have to thinking, why was that witness up there? He didn't say anything that makes me look at Vince McMahon and go, yeah, you should go away, which is the whole point of the trial, of a trial, not just this one. And yeah, completely on point there. And he's got a situation where if he offers no witnesses in Vince McMahon's defense, the leap of faith is that the jury is going to interpret that as confidence as opposed to anxiety about what someone might say up there. You know, because a juror might just as quickly say, yeah, of course he didn't put any witnesses up there. He couldn't find anybody to say anything to defend Vince McMahon.
Yeah. No, of course. And he was smart in that regard, too. And I also feel like, you know, we are burying the lead a little bit here, because, you know, you said on your guys' show that you read through the entire court transcripts of this trial. And that I failed to mention at the top of the show was a big influence in doing the episode, because it sort of made me see. I remember it was during the pandemic when this was hitting and you guys were covering this, right? And I do remember listening to your show and, you know, all these things that I had never known about the trial, or all these details, these little cinematic moments, these little dramatic moments that it came out of you guys just going through the raw transcripts really inspired me to see how it could be, you know, brought to the screen in some way. And, of course, you know, you guys did what, 800 hours on that? How many is it?
700. I mean, Jesus, don't.
No, it's like 60 hours, right?
It's as long as always. Yeah, I mean, it's as long as it needed to be.
Okay.
That's right.
It is a lot, but right. I dedicated myself to it, took that ride, and then really was like, you know, these guys need to be involved in the making of this show because you guys know it more probably than anybody at this point. You're the Jerry McDivitts of the steroid trials story. So it was vital. And, you know, and talking about structuring this episode, it was almost impossible because there was so much nuance and minutia that we had to sculpt in terms of, you know, it not being too much information and overloading people. And so they could follow along with these complicated ideas of, like you were saying, when the law changed and the jurisdiction of this trial and the venue and like things that we never talk about on Dark Side. You know, we had to make sure we were nailing, and you guys, you know, and you know, Jack, you definitely helped a lot in putting that together. So had to
throw
that out there.
Thank you for that. And it was, because everyone wants to know at the heart, how did Vince get off? Right. Like, cause people remember him being in trouble. If you're a fan of any vintage, but you know, to answer that question, it's going to take, you know, how much time do you have? You know, it's not so simple because there was a bunch of charges in the beginning. And by the time it was over, as Jerry McDivitt does a rather brilliant job of sort of mocking on the episode and in the interviews, a conspiracy to defraud the FDA charge, which, you know, it's just, it boggles the mind just to hear that in terms of like, that's where it ended up. But you have to, like you said, walk through it. So as all this, you know, prosecutorial scrutiny is falling upon Vince, the WWF, everyone who works for him, everyone who ever did work for him, seeking information about steroids and wrestling, and to hear others tell it, all kinds of things. Apparently, prosecutors cast a really wide net. They were asking about much more than steroid distribution. To hear Jerry McDivitt tell it, they were just looking to find whatever seemed to have the best hook to get Vince McMahon convicted. Basically, they decided Vince McMahon was worth putting away, it seems like. And so as this is happening and the pressure is building, you know, there's conventional ways to deal with this. You hunker down, you don't make a lot of noise, you certainly, you know, don't make yourself available for further scrutiny while you're under this kind of investigation. But Jerry, you're representing Vince McMahon. You're representing somebody who will pretty much do what he wants and deal with the fallout in almost like a magical way, where suddenly he's still standing in the end, and then the trial outcome is testimony to that. But there's a point in time, and he told Dark Side cameras this, where Vince makes a radical suggestion to Jerry McDivitt in terms of, well, you know, if they want to talk to me about what was happening in my company, if they're, you know, subpoenaing dozens and dozens of people to find out what's going on in my company, why don't they just ask me what's going on in my company?
He also was very proactive in terms of, like, why won't they talk to me? I mean, I'll answer anything they want to know. Why won't they talk to me? And he explained to them, well, that's, they don't want to because they don't really want to know what you have to say. You're the target, et cetera, et cetera. So one day I remember he just said, the hell with this. We're going to go down and we're going to go in and meet the U.S. attorney. Just go down and knock on the door and think you're going to get in. Yeah, okay. So we do. So we get down to the office of the U.S. attorney. I forget who it was at the time. Might have been Mary Jo White or Zach Carter. I can't remember which it was. And he and I, and I think Linda was with us, you know, we walk into the U.S. attorney's office just like any normal person would. And the person at the counter, I think, almost fell over when they saw it. They said, we're here, we'd like to meet the U.S. attorney. We'd like to talk to her about this investigation. Well, they didn't know what to do. I mean, they had nobody ever does that kind of stuff. I remember one of the criminal investigators, a guy named Valenti, that was working the case, was there. He was shell-shocked. He had no idea what to do. And they were so cowardly, they wouldn't even meet with us. And wouldn't talk to us. And so here you have this person that you're targeting the charge coming and saying, here, you have anyone want to ask me anything? Ask me whatever you want to ask me. And they were gutless. They wouldn't do it.
You have to think, JP, he walked in with the swagger and the Vince walk, right?
What do you want to know? Come on, I'm here. I got nothing to hide. I'll tell you exactly what you want to know.
It's like a mob boss walking in to a U.S. attorney's office.
Yes.
I hear you got a problem with what's going on in my neighborhood.
You're not a fan of my business and my day-to-day activities. What can I do for you? How can I help?
Evan, it's all right there. And you can hear even in Jerry's voice, and he's dealt with a lot of characters in his line of work.
Oh, like, yeah.
Nobody is like, let's just go confront the U.S. attorney in his office.
Man, I mean, it is mildly heartbreaking that that's not in the episode, because it really demonstrates why Jerry and Vince are such a great tag team, you know? This idea of, because that really is, that's a pro wrestling move, right?
Oh, yeah.
And bringing in a pro wrestling sort of tactic, minorly intimidating, but getting yourself over, you know, doing something unexpected, for, you know.
No matter what happens, you have a great story that reflects upon your, like, guts, right?
Sure. The show of it. The spectacle of it, you know, it's so uniquely Vince too, you know, to do something like that. And for him to see the value in it, him to probably see how this could be strategically beneficial to him from a legal standpoint, because he wouldn't have probably authorized it otherwise, because it is so wildly and unconventional, right? But I think it does illustrate that. And it is, again, it's a scene out of a movie, you know, by saying mob boss too, it made me think what you were saying earlier about the charges. They felt they could get some weird, esoteric charge to stick like you would a mob boss, like you would with, like, you know, not paying your taxes or whatever. Right,
By the time it was over, yeah. I mean, they came with distribution charges and everything, but during the course of the trial, everything falls apart besides this quirky conspiracy charge. They're sort of grasping at straws, I think is a fair read of it. And, you know, you hear in that clip, too, I feel like you hear Jerry becoming a little more like Vince as Vince becomes a little more like Jerry. Because you have Jerry saying, no, you shouldn't do this. And by the time it's over, Jerry's like, they're gutless.
Yes.
It's like, I just learned something from Vince. Like, if we do this, knowing there's almost a 0% chance we'll meet with anybody, we can walk out of there saying they were afraid of us.
Totally. And, you know, obviously you could say it's also a little, you know, Donald Trumpian as well, too.
Oh, totally. We
do something very similar to that.
Yep, the playbook's definitely overlapped.
Playbook WWE Hall of Famer, so there you go. You think Jerry McDevitt will ever get inducted into the Hall of Fame?
I don't know.
Why he's not in the first class, I don't understand, you know?
You guys did ask him, like, if he was ever considered being on TV, because they did come up with an angle one time where they thought they could use him on TV, and he shied away from that. He didn't mind, like, someone saying on TV, we need to call Jerry, which did happen once on Monday Night Raw, but he didn't want to actually be on television, so I think
he was foreseeing how that would be used against him in a courtroom at some point.
Yeah, I think you can write. Is this really an attorney, right, Your Honor, or is this a carny?
He didn't want to pull a Dr. Zahorian, if you know what I mean.
JP, one thing that came through strongly in those transcripts was the level of, I guess you could say, frustration, but almost bewilderment from the judge in Vince McMahon's trial. Jacob Mishler, who was a veteran of the bench, I think he was honestly in his 80s when this trial happened.
Yes, indeed.
Wild.
And, you know, Jacob Mishler.
Wild. You hear the back and forth as Jerry just, like a dog with a bone, like refuses to cede any point in sidebar conversations with the prosecutor and the judge and him, or objections are flying all over the place. And you come away, right, with this idea that this judge is just like, what? Why did I have to get this case?
Yeah, my swan song.
That's what it seems like. All this guy, like, just come on, get this over with. Like, it, you know, because I think even in the beginning, he said, like, he just wanted this. He was hoping this thing would just go a couple days. But it goes on 2 weeks, and
it comes. Maybe if you're in the court, you know, that's not a fair read of him. But I mean, just on the printed page, it definitely seems that way.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. In the courtroom, it could be a whole different thing. I don't know, like, but the way that the transcripts read, this guy just, you know, he just wanted to go home, get dinner, you know, have a glass of bourbon, and go to bed.
Didn't you, like, guys have a bit on your show when you were doing that whole part about the judge, about how he, like, had a sandwich at home, half a sandwich at home with his name on it or something he wanted to get to?
Because his family, Jacob Mishler's family, they had a deli, I think is what it was.
Yeah, Mishler's deli.
So he
yeah.
ran with that. Yeah. I think that's what it was. He was a pretty well-known judge. I mean, he was a celebrated jurist. He,
there you go.
He
there
had
you
decades,
go.
I think, on the court. And but, you know, so coming in, Evan, with that kind of, you know, you think imagined sense of the judge's countenance in mind when I'm reading this transcript of what Jerry said about the judge, and my eyes just lit up because, I mean, if that's the takeaway we had of of Jacob Mishler's relative interest in what's happening here in Vince McMahon's trial. Jerry McDevitt gave us all the support we needed in that view.
At the age he was at the time of our trial, he would literally vacillate back and forth between lucidity and senility in the middle of the trial.
And it was, that's going to be okay? I can pause for a second. I'm going to have to start that one over.
Jerry,
okay?
Jerry.
Here we go.
At the age he was at the time of our trial, he would literally vacillate back and forth between lucidity and senility in the middle of the trial. And it was a problem because, you know, he was sort of, he had some of the characteristics of a grouchy old man at 85 years old. And he would get irritated because he couldn't understand some of the things he was hearing and whatnot. And you know, 90% of the battle with him was trying to tell him, the jury needs to understand the problems of this case, is that what the government's trying to do here is take a situation where men were using a drug. But it was completely legal for them to do during the entire time frame of this indictment and try to turn it into a crime. You need to tell the jury that it was completely legal for these men to be taking this drug. You may not like it, you may think they shouldn't have, but it didn't violate any federal criminal law, and it didn't. And, you know, the whole time you're sitting there thinking, my God, this man's liberty is at issue, and we have a judge who's in the middle of the cross-examination waking up and saying objection sustained when, in fact, no objection had even been made.
That happened.
You go up to the sidebar and you say, there was no objection. And he'd get grouchy and tell, well, I told you, Mr. McDivitt, don't do this or whatever.
Whoa.
You know? And you'd go back to cross-examining and trusting that he's going to go back to sleep in a couple minutes anyway, and I'll just go right back to it, which is what I would do. You know, because I'm not going to not defend my client. I'm going to make the points I have to make on cross-examination, whether he's awake or whether he's asleep.
That is amazing.
You're going to tell me he didn't learn a thing or two from Vince? Come on, folks. Dude, you feel like
my God.
Yeah, a total takedown. And like I said, it comes across, but he just he went right at that, Evan. He was like ready for that one.
Seriously. He's a natural promo, you know.
So he gets a lot of mileage out of that. And, you know, this is the, so you can start to enliven this courtroom. One of the things that's true that people might not realize about federal court in the United States, which is to say, you know, the highest charges, the federal charges, the ones that cross state lines. You notice there, Jerry said it was perfectly legal to take. There was no federal law there. He said federal law because there were state laws against the steroid possession. But that's another debate for another day. They were not in state court. They were in federal court. And in federal court, U.S. court, no cameras are allowed, still or video. So unlike a lot of trials we're used to seeing at the state level, like OJ's trial and things like that, there's no video of what's happening in this courtroom because they're not allowed in there. That's why you see these sketches whenever it gets into federal court, because that's the only depiction of what's happening that's allowed. And so we're sort of left to imagine through recollections from a Jerry McDevitt and the transcript of what it was actually like in that room. And the episode does a great job bringing that to life. One of the moments that's key from a legal significance perspective that isn't in the episode, but I think when you study the subject for a while, you realize how important it was when a renowned steroid expert by the name of Dr. Gary Wadler takes the stand.
Oh, boy.
What Jerry would call steroid hysteria of the late 80s in this country, Gary Wadler was constantly on television talking about the dangers of steroids, talking about, you know, how doctors aren't operating as doctors if they're prescribing these things for anything other than, you know, treatments of disease and things like that. And so Jerry does his whole deep dive and finds that, you know, treatment of disease was never the reason these drugs were developed and brought to market. They were developed and brought to market to give athletes competitive advantages like the Russians were having in the Olympics in powerlifting. It's that simple. And tacked on the disease part later after, you know, 20, 30 years of athletes becoming dependent on these things to compete. And so that all said, Gary Wadler is up there on the stand in Vince's trial. He had very effectively, I think, testified for the government against George Zahorian, the aforementioned doctor who was convicted of illegally distributing steroids to WWF wrestlers as well as other athletes and people. And so Wadler's up there to do it again, you know, to take questions from the prosecution that make it seem like somehow Vince McMahon was party to what illegitimate practices were taking place in getting steroids into wrestlers' hands. And as far as I could tell, no one had really unmoored Gary Wadler's authority yet. No one, you know, No one had ever really been able to call into question why this guy was so, you know, why there was so much deference to him when it came to the subject of steroids and the appropriate way to prescribe them to people. And so Jerry McDevitt absolutely comes ready. He saw what had happened in Zaharian's trial. He knew pretty much exactly what Wilder was going to say. And you have to hand it to Jerry McDevitt. He comes in not only prepared, but I think by the time it's over, Gary Wadler doesn't seem as credible as he always had been to Vince's jury.
He'd always testify about, well, one of the things that happens is you get these blood-filled liver cysts that will rupture and kill you. And he would always say that in these trials in ways that made it sound like this was a common phenomenon associated with taking these drugs for enhancement of athletic performance or whatnot. And I, when I was in college, I was a biology and chemistry major, so I wasn't afraid of jumping into the science. And I started going down to medical libraries and Pitt and whatnot and looking up, well, how many reported cases are there of this? And he also wrote a book. I brought it with me. You can actually still see.
It still has the exhibit number
on it.
I remember
he had
that.
He had written this book called Drugs and the Athlete, in which he did the same thing. I had known from my research that the number of instances where a person taking steroids for athletic enhancement or performance enhancement, there were zero reported cases of anybody getting blood-filled liver cysts from that. There had been something like in the whole history of steroids over decades, something like 22 anecdotal reported cases of older people who had been taking them for some kind of therapeutic purpose, like gaining weight after surgery or something like that, that they had experienced this. 22 anecdotal cases in anything medical is statistically insignificant. You wouldn't even talk about that under normal circumstances.
Well, there goes Gary Wadler, at least as far as the jury was concerned, apparently. And Evan, he held up the book. He not only brought the book, but apparently he still has the original exhibit marking on Gary Wadler's book all these years later.
I do remember that. I do remember that moment for sure, that he still had that. And I remember the page was marked and the whole thing. And I was like, this is classic. It's classic.
And the fact that he brought the book or had it right there, that's just money.
He had a lot of exhibits, you know, with him.
Yes, he was prepared for an exhibition, if you will.
It's like the Hard Rock Cafe of the steroid trial.
It's got it all. All the trinkets can come right off the wall and be activated to recall them.
He's got his, you know, the suits that he wore in court. He's got them like behind a glass case,
and he's got a WWE championship belt in his office. That's one of the first things you see in the Dark Side episode, which is kind of cool.
Yep.
So he's definitely a collector of those like mementos and things. And another, you know, thing, I mean, can you just imagine coming up against a defense that has done this much research into not only Vince McMahon's alleged culpability here or lack thereof, but the whole history of steroid use and distribution and creation and regulation in this country, and is coming with documents from FDA meetings from the 70s and the 80s where they're discussing what drugs should and shouldn't be on the market and finding discrepancies and finding, you know, people flagging drugs as they shouldn't be on shelves, but the FDA never took them off the shelves. There's no way that the prosecution is ready for this. There's no way even the Gary Wadler is ready for to come up against an attorney that's read every word of his book with through the lens of this guy is full of crap, you know, and I'm going to find any hole I can. I'm not saying that Gary Wilder is full of crap. I'm saying he's coming up against someone who's got that pair of shades on and reading his book, and what a job it was. So I guess the coup de grace, you could say, or at least a moment that Jerry McDevitt saw as symbolic of the collapsing of the government's case. And you have to say, when you read through it and all the testimony from people that were there, like the Dave Meltzers and the Wade Kellers and the John Arezzi's, people who followed the trial as it happened at the time, you did sort of see the prosecution's case fall apart bit by bit by bit, witness by witness. It was just going nowhere, and arguments were being thrown out, charges were being dropped in the body of the trial, the jury was being given instructions that were not favorable to the prosecution's case necessarily in terms of, you know, interpretation of the law and things like that and questions of fact. They arrive at a moment where the prosecution is about to put a big blown-up version of an infamous memo that was sent by Vince McMahon's wife, Linda, to Pat Patterson and others within the organization saying, we cannot have this George Zahorian at our events anymore. Because we received a tip, essentially, it's not worded precisely that way, but we received a tip that Dr. Zahorian is under investigation. He's hot, and we cannot have him around. And so,
at the shows, yeah.
At the shows, thank you, yes. You know, potentially giving out steroids to wrestlers. And that was always pointed to as some, you know, evidence of some kind of conspiracy, you know, where the WWF had the warm line.
Yeah, because just to, before you play it, yeah, the, just for those who may not be as familiar with the story, you know, Dr. Zahorian was the State Athletic Commission appointed doctor who would go to all the WWF shows. He checked the blood pressure of all the wrestlers, you know, before going in. He'd do all that typical stuff. But he also would supply each of the wrestlers with steroids. And slowly, as the culture shifted with, you know, the attitude towards steroids, and they were able to get, you know, some incriminating evidence against him showing that Dr. Zahorian was in fact not really acting much like a doctor anymore and more like a drug dealer, then they basically started to investigate him. And I think it was like, it was a tip, like somebody at a party who knew Linda had basically said, like, they were bumped elbows at some event and said, like, you know, watch Dr. Zahorian, you know, or something to that effect. And that's where you get this memo.
And so here you have McDevitt talking about that memo and why he really wasn't that worried about it as some kind of smoking gun. And he actually delineates the circumstances that you're talking about, Evan. You guys do a great job sort of trying to get him to remember, well, who did tip off who here? And he, you know, isn't quite sure if it was an associate of his that was tipped off at this cocktail party, is the way it's been described, that Zahorian is under investigation. But here we get, I think, as close to the truth as we can on who said what to whom at this party. But also the viewpoint of the prosecution towards this memo as being some kind of a smoking gun, this killer piece of evidence, just it totally falls apart in front of their eyes. Now, we should note before we play this that in the past, the former U.S. attorney who's being referenced has denied having tipped off McDevitt's partner. Let's listen in.
Well, what happened, and this is why it was never that big of a deal, they tried to make it a big deal, but what happened was the U.S. attorney in Harrisburg was not keeping it a secret that they were investigating George Zahorian. And he was at a cocktail party and told one of my law partners that they were investigating George Zahorian and said, well, maybe I shouldn't even have told you that because, you know, WWE's involved with him, et cetera, which made no effort to keep any of it secret. So they were themselves the ones that put it out there that Zahorian was being investigated. And if you do that, you know it's going to get back to George Zahorian.
And so just so it's clear too, so someone part of the Harrisburg officials bumped into someone, one of your partners, and told them?
The U.S. attorney.
Wow.
The head prosecutor in charge of the Zahorian prosecution. That's who it was. We would have no way of knowing. How would we know? And I think it was almost symbolic, Evan. At the end of the trial, you're doing closing arguments. He had that memo all blown up and like this was some big deal that he was going to concentrate on in his closing. Well, it was almost symbolic when he got up to put his thing on the easel to begin his closing argument, the whole thing collapsed and fell on the floor, which I thought, and I think I might have even said to the jury, it's sort of symbolic because that's what had happened to his case too. It sort of collapsed and fell on the floor just like that memo. And it really had no impact. It was obvious by the jury verdict.
You guys knew about that from reading in the transcripts, right? Because he must have mentioned that in the closing.
To my memory, it wasn't that clear what he was making reference to.
Okay.
Just reading his words, you can't necessarily tell what it was the jury saw with their eyes that he's referring to.
I just remember maybe when I first heard it in this very moment we just heard, I just was thinking, oh my God, this has to be a reenactment moment,
right.
You know, in the episode. Because I know we shot it. I definitely know we
shot
it.
Oh yeah, I've seen it.
Yeah, because we shot it.
Yeah.
Maybe we use it in the episode as just a cutaway, like you don't know the context of it. But yeah, that definitely is something that was like, wow, you can't even write this. You know, it's so, and it's almost like you feel bad for the guy, you know, Sean O'Shea, who is the prosecutor of the case. And he was someone we did try to get actually all the different times that we tried to put this episode together. And the very first time that we reached out to him during season one, I think that's the only time we had actual correspondence with him. He basically was like, yeah, I have a policy of, you know, not talking about trials that, you know, that I didn't win, or I don't know how he phrased it, you know? So it was kind of like, ugh, But we tried to go back to the well, you know, every time that we tried to, every season we tried to get this episode made and never heard anything back. And it's unfortunate because it really would be interesting to hear what his perspective was or if he's even able to divulge it, because who knows, maybe he was saddled with a very difficult dog of a case that he had to try and, you know, make some sense of, you know, because you can tell his frustration in the closing, his closing arguments in the trial, from what I remember, was, you know, very inflammatory, almost very desperate seeming, you know, just trying to go for the emotion of, here's this monster, this Vince McMahon guy who only sees his wrestlers as pieces of meat, you know. And yeah, but I think by the time that, you know, Jerry got up there for his closing and was able to deliver that zinger, you know, I think it was already decided by that point.
I remember when we were reading through them that it became very clear very early on that, I mean, again, it could have been hindsight, I don't know, but it definitely came across like the prosecution was just not really prepared for it. Like, it just, their case just was paper thin to begin with, and it just fell apart from the moment, from the first day.
It was meandering. They were sort of like resetting in the course of the trial, and perhaps, you know, they had the whole it's delineated well in the episode, so no reason to revisit it here. But, you know, when you want to peg your claim of distribution on, you know, a limo going to the Nassau Coliseum to get Hulk Hogan steroids, and then McDevitt and others come up and say, we weren't even in the Nassau Coliseum on the date you mentioned. That's the kind of thing that tells you that they didn't, you know, do a lot of I's dotting and T crossing ahead of time to offer that up with such an easy rebuttal point. But who knows, you know, Sean O'Shea, the prosecutor there, has never talked about this trial as far as I know. And thus we get this, that let's turn it over to Jerry. And it turned out to be deeply compelling. And I think now fans, thanks to this episode, you know, who know that Vince McMahon was in a lot of trouble in the 90s, have this sort of vague recollection of it. Now perhaps they're a little closer to understanding how the most successful wrestling promoter in the history of the planet walked back in 1994. So we do want to thank you once again for joining us here on Dark Side of the Ring Unheard as we continue to plumb the depths of the archives, Evan. Any closing thoughts?
My closing argument on this
is...
Well, you know, it is interesting. I rewatched the episode for the first time since it aired, you know, a few years ago. And, man, just getting hit with how hard it was to put together. And, you know, I think I mentioned this to you, Jack. It definitely broke a few people on our team.
you know,
trying to make sense of this, you know. I mean, you could only imagine. It's like, you know, we were working on the case itself, you know. It was so dizzying. So I definitely got re-triggered by that, like, of how difficult it was to put assemble this and to make sure that, you know, we are covering, you know, enough of it, but there's still more. Obviously, you guys know, doing so many hours on it, that there's so much more to get out there, and hearing these clips tonight of like what could have been, you know, things we could have put in the episode for different dramatic flair. But I was pretty proud of the episode watching it back, and just, you know, because knowing how difficult it was. And I think it does feel like a very different episode than our typical standard fare. I think it was pretty successful in what it set out to do. And no thanks to you, you know, no thanks to you, Jack, you know, helping, you know, for sure. I mean, like, thank you so much for all the help you gave us on that episode. But my last little takeaway on Vince, it's like, you know, playing what if a little bit. It's like, on two different things. Obviously, if he didn't win the case, you know, what would have happened to wrestling history? But also, like, because he went through this and because it happened, you know, and he did get the confidence of winning a trial and becoming the victor, and, you know, I just beat the government, you know, it does wonder of how much that sort of played into the Vince McMahon, you know, we know today as somebody who did, you know, of course, become this larger than life sort of, you know, character, not only on television, but also as this, you know, sort of mogul behind this large sports entertainment company. And I it's interesting to see if, you know, and if, you know, Jim Neidhart didn't wander into that office that day, you know, what would have happened. It's fascinating.
Definitely fascinating, and definitely, you know, gave the the pep into the step of a Vince McMahon who would end up being that guy on television, you know, as well as in moments of trials and tribulations, literally and figuratively. But back when he was just a TV announcer. So once again, we want to thank everybody for joining us and do encourage you to stay tuned. We're going to continue to find these gems and surface them for everybody to hear. The Dark Side Archive is so deep, and we really look forward to bringing you many more notable voices from across the wrestling spectrum here on the show. For now, it's back to the vault, and we'll see you next time on Dark Side of the Ring Unheard.